And now, Icon Art Radio.
Hi, it's Bill Teeple for Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby. And today our guest is Bill Brunel from New York City, a professional magician, a magic man. You have known Bill, Alan, for close to 40 years, so maybe you could say a word of introduction.
Yeah, Bill and I have been good friends for a long, long time, since college. And we got to know each other in the context of hypnosis originally. I'd been studying medical hypnosis and reading a lot of books of theory, and had gotten to the point where the whole thing seemed so complicated that I really wasn't sure I would ever, you know, be able to remember all of the things I had to remember to do it properly. And I discovered that Bill, as part of his evolution as a magician, had done some stage hypnosis. You know, we've all seen stage acts using hypnosis. And his view of it was a very simple thing and didn't involve all the complexities that I had been studying about. So anyway, that's how we first got to know each other, and we've been good friends for 4 decades since then. Along the way, I was his senior project advisor when he started the first TM Center in Vermont. I guess was it the first in New England at the time?
No, Cambridge Center.
That's it. Right. He's the one who finally convinced me to try TM, and I sort of grudgingly tried it, discovered that it actually works. So I have a variety of attitudes about what Bill does. He's been a professional magician for his entire life in one form or another. And the thing that I guess is particularly interesting to me is the relationship between a performing art like magic and what we kind of conventionally think of as fine arts. And I think my first question would just be, what do you see as the relationship between being a performing magician and the whole notion of art and creativity? If that's not too vague a question. It is a bit vague. I mean, do you think of magic as an art?
I will tip it at this point that we just did this show for half an hour, and now we're going in a completely different direction, and it's going to take a little more digging here.
This is the second show.
I won't say why we're redoing it.
First show is going to be aired in Alaska, and we, for copyright reasons, we have to do a different version for the local area. I guess, you know,
creative process or art, which one do you want me to jump on?
Well, initially, I guess my first question was, do you see the performance that you do as an art form? I mean, you could call it mime,
I do more and more. I used to have a lot of feeling that what I did was sort of, that I was a hack, sort of.
Fortunately, I never thought of you that way.
I think that's pretty common, actually, for artists who are critical of their work. And
And
I have been particularly critical of mine because I've taken such unconventional routes to get there. I did feel that a lot of what I was seeing among magicians, and I felt this from a very young age, I saw all the magicians on Ed Sullivan, and none of the ones that came out and floated ladies or made elephants disappear or did that stuff appealed to me, because it seemed to me, even at age 11 or 12, to be screamingly obvious that the magic was inherent in the props and not in the magician.
Yeah. Hmm.
But the guy who could come out and roll his sleeves up and produce cards out of thin air was much more interesting to me.
Yeah, which, by the way, I have to take a moment to throw this in, and I don't know how much I shouldn't give away about how that trick is done.
Maybe we could come back to it without mentioning that trick. because I think I know the story you're going
we'll
come back to it.
All right, I'll let you direct us back to that, and we'll keep the audience in suspense.
So when you were a little kid, did you have a kind of magical bent? Like, just in general, did you think of life as magic? Were you like a child of wonder or something? Or how did your interest in being a magician first begin?
My father had an advertising and PR firm in Hartford, Connecticut. And his closest friend was his art director. And he had been an amateur magician. And so from, I don't know, probably as old as I you generally find when I look at kids seeing magic, it's not until they're around 3 that they really appreciate that something's impossible, because everything's possible till around that age, and then they start to realize this is really unusual, this scarf is disappearing, or things are multiplying that aren't supposed to multiply, or that kind of thing. And so it was probably around that age when he started doing little magic stuff that I would see. And then he teased me for a long time. He took 2 pieces of string and tied them together, and then wrapped it up in his hand and took some magic woofle dust from his pocket and sprinkled it on, and it became one piece of string. And he was very, very good, because he didn't teach me how to do it for a long time, for at least what seemed like a long time at that age. And when he finally did teach it to me, it was really special to learn the secret. And so I continued to learn from him. And when I was probably around in the 7th or 8th grade, I wanted to be a lawyer. And I was going to court and cornering the DA and watching all the stuff. And I was a precocious, persistent kid. And my father had an attorney in the office next to him. He had said, Bill wants to know what he should. He doesn't want to wait till law school. He wants to start reading the stuff now. And so they sent me a pamphlet called Careers in Law, which I thought was really condescending, and I didn't want to do that. So, but nobody told me I was too young to do magic. So starting around 11 or 12, I started getting really serious and did my first show when I was 14, and started doing it that way. It was the one avenue that I could be precociously adult-like, but with something that was acceptable for a kid to be doing.
Well, not only acceptable, but I think it was probably kind of an extra special thing. I know adult audiences love to see young people do something amazing. So, right. You know, you probably had success with adult audiences as well as children, back then.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, the question Donna asked, I realized as she was saying it that I remember, including myself to some extent, you know, as a kid, people learning how to fool adults or how to fool each other using, you know, magic apparatus of one kind or another. And yet the appeal wasn't magic in the sense that we mean it now. It's, you know, the wonder of it and the, you know, breaking boundaries and seeing beyond the veil. It was really the fun of tricking someone and knowing something they didn't know. And yet I just came back from visiting a toy company in Toronto, and I sat in on some product planning sessions. We looked at some competitors' products, and we looked at some submitted products that they were thinking of doing. And in every case, the criterion that finally decided whether they were going to do the product or not was whether it gave them a sense of magic. If the product didn't have something magical about it, they didn't want to do it. And so there's a notion of what magical means that I think in a lot of performing magicians kind of gets lost in the craft of just being sneaky and being clever.
And I think, you know, that they do get caught up in the thing that you described of there is for a kid particularly, there is some thrill in being able to fool not only other kids but adults.
Yeah.
But I think if you don't go beyond that, and I guess I think a lot of magicians performing don't go beyond that,
right.
It becomes repetitive and tedious after a while. It does become real pedestrian hackery.
Yeah.
And
Well, that kind of goes back to your first question about is it art? Because I think the way that you produce art out of a career like that is by each time approaching it, like as an artist approaches a canvas or whatever their medium happens to be, with this experimental or exploratory attitude.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, you were talking before we started recording this show about incorporating theater into and persona, you know, characters and all that into your performances. So can you talk about that a little bit now and how that brings real magic into the sleight of hand aspect?
Yeah, I mean, there's a phrase that magicians use a lot, and it's also used in theater circles, which is there needs to be a willing suspension of disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you go into a theatrical production and you start caring about all these fake people on stage, and if one of them dies, you're upset if you like them, or you're thrilled if it's the villain and they're finally getting theirs, mm-hmm. or you know, whatever. And with magic, there needs to be, I think, for people to really enjoy being fooled, there needs, instead of them just being put down, and a lot of magicians, if anybody saw the exposure shows that the Fox Channel mm-hmm. did several years ago, they did a series of these exposure shows, and their subtext, their attitude as they exposed the tricks of magicians to the audience was sort of like, see how easy it is, stupid?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because they were picking, first of all, they invented a lot of fake tricks that weren't in the repertoires of working magicians anyway. And then they would expose it, and they had to pick stuff that could be exposed in 30 seconds. Hmm. And it would be, you know, so the exposure then consists of showing where's the trap door or the mirror in the box or the whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that's like saying to somebody, you're going to teach them the secrets of painting by showing them, oh, I use a brush and I use paint. That's the secret.
Yeah.
No.
And that's how they do it.
There's a lot more that goes into it than the equipment involved or the actual point of deception. There's how do you cloak that in a way that there's not even any feeling of where the moment is that you were fooled.
Well, there's one illusion that you do, some close-up magic, where you take these huge English pennies and you smack them in
silver dollars.
And you put them through a card table into a bucket that you're holding under the table, and you watch this presentation sitting on the other side of the table, a foot away from where these things disappear, and Bill takes the coin and he holds it up in the air, and you see it in his hand, and then he puts it down onto the table and it's gone. You heard it hit the table, you hear it fall into the bucket, and you know intellectually that somewhere along the line, obviously, you weren't watching the coin when you thought you were. But I've had people tell me with complete conviction that they saw the coin hit the table and disappear. And I myself...
Oh, yeah, you do.
Yeah, and I myself remember seeing the coin disappearing en route to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, you know, your senses are obviously, to a certain extent, recording what's happening, but to another extent, your senses are giving you what you believe.
But I think it's just like a painting or a movie.
Mm-hmm.
There is a limited amount of information given people's brain,
mm-hmm.
and their brain fills in the gaps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, cinema was invented by a French magician. I forget his name now, but he
oh, yeah. Well, was the guy that whose films we just showed was the French magician.
Oh.
Well, I can't think of his name right now.
But it's, you know, a magician is creating, and I think our minds function as magicians. We create pieces of reality. We create our own movies, if you will, and they're just still frames. And they give a certain amount of information, and then what people fill in the gaps is different for each person,
right.
Which is why one person sees the coin disappearing as it hits the table, one person never sees it disappear, one person says they saw it disappearing as it was going to the table.
Right.
I've had people see the same trick and describe the effect of what happened completely differently.
Yeah.
One person thinks it's mind reading, one person thinks it's a mental prediction, another person thinks it's a demonstration of synchronicity.
Well, in any audience, too, you're going to have a whole range of, you're going to have the people who just want to believe in magic. You know, they would never watch a show that exposes the secrets or the tricks because they just want to believe it's magic. Yeah. And then there are the people who are always skeptical and, you know, looking for how you do it. And I would imagine as a magician that it's more fun to perform for the ones who just want to be completely open to,
well,
you know.
Well, I think where the art comes in is where you create a more tantalizing invitation for people to do that suspension of disbelief and enter that world and have fun with it and embrace it. I've even discussed this a little bit when I've done some corporate trainings where they're interested in change management and adapting to change, and I'll talk about magic being a metaphor for change, for the world of Maya, for the world of the relative, and suggest that people monitor how do they respond to magic. Are they embracing it and going with it the way that somebody who's effective and flowing well within an organization does in adapting to change? Or are they sitting with their arms folded saying, I'm going to figure out how this guy does it? And then do they get won over or not by the change? Because magic is a radical change in people's reality.
But you must get your satisfaction out of winning over an audience, like bringing them into magic.
I love it.
I mean, that would be the whole thing to me.
And part of how I think, I said to you earlier when we weren't on the air, that I got myself in acting and voice and movement classes because that's part of the tools that I wanted to use for doing that, is how to make it fun. And how I think part of what I've sort of evolved as a style, and it's part of who I am anyway, is wanting to make magic much more interactive. A lot of things like magic or juggling are, tend to be done as demonstrations of skill, or they're done at people. And I like to do as much stuff where it's hands-on, and if people are interrupting me, it's great, and they become more a part of the magic that way.
Do you take on actual characters? You said you took acting classes and all that. Do you have certain specific characters that you use over and over again in your shows?
I have a little bit. I often close my stage show talking about the first time I ever saw magic at the circus when I was 5 or 6 years old. And then I become this sort of circus barker character that was pulling money out of the air and dropping it into a clanging bucket and going, gather round ye misers all, find a coin and watch it fall. And the coins start appearing at that point, and circus music playing and stuff.
That's great.
Well, I think in a way, even just being yourself doing some of those illusions is a kind of acting or even dance, because the movement is critical to the way it works. And you've got to make these very precise movements be natural, which means you have to fit them into the reality that you're doing. I mean, especially if you're doing it up close or at a table with people.
I'll give for anybody who's listening who has any interest in practicing magic, I'll give a little tip that sort of fits in with this whole idea of natural movement. The Society of American Magicians might give me a hard time about what I'm about to say, but I don't think I'm revealing too much to the audience to say that sometimes if a small object like a coin or a ball is placed into a hand, some of the rudimentary ways that every kid has tried to learn is you pretend to place it in one hand while secretly keeping it in the original hand. And one of the ways to practice that is not just to do the move, not just to move the finger the right way that retains it in the hand when it's looking like it's in the right hand when it's looking like it's going into the left, but to what is natural, and to stand in front of the mirror and actually take the coin and place it from the right hand into the left to see what are the motions that the hands go through when you do that, and study that, and then make it look exactly the same way or have the same rhythm to it, so that even when people know the principle, they'll still swear that thing actually went into the left hand.
Yeah.
My daughter is in theater, and she's very fond of stage combat, which mm-hmm. is all fake,
right.
but has to look like it's real. And every little bit of it is choreographed, but it's just like you were describing. They watch what a real one looks like, you know, and
right.
Make sure that those moves
yeah,
are
so
authentic, and everyone believes
slugging
it.
You in the jaw,
yeah.
but not. It's supposed to look like they're slugging you in the jaw, and you got to look. What is it? You know, what point? What muscles are reacting
yeah.
and responding?
Yeah,
and it can get very detailed. Mm-hmm. We talked about this before. My teacher Slidini, mm-hmm. this little old Italian man who reinvented modern day close up magic, has been unsurpassed in this quality.
Yeah,
because he didn't think about it intellectually, I'm sure, because God knows I grilled him and tried to get him to articulate it more intellectually than he ever did. But he somehow knew his own very unique Italian body language, all the flamboyant Italian gestures and stuff. I wish we don't have a camera here, but I'll do it for you guys. If you know, he'd do swirling hand washing like this, and move his hands one around the other, and within that he hid the moves. Uh-huh. So even if he just gestured "watch" with his hand, he'd go "watch." Hmm. You know, on the offbeat he'd do the dirty work. On the gesture of "watch," then there'd be "watch." Pause, watch, rest, mm-hmm. the arm would come down on the rest beat.
Wonderful.
And that's when the dirty work would happen.
Yeah.
So that's what I think Alan's talking about with the body language.
Yeah.
It has to look natural for the illusion to be there.
Yeah.
Or it can look highly stylized. Slidini
right.
was a master of both. Slidini would do this very natural Italian, albeit Italian gesture, watch. Or he'd start doing these kind of dance-like motions and gestures
yeah,
and hiding the moves
movements.
In there. And mm. sometimes you'd think he was doing a move when he wasn't, and he was just playing with you. And
Which is something, I mean, it so captivates an audience to watch the whole body of a person who's moving on a stage. Like, it's like a Fellini movie, you know, where
right.
you're just so conscious of the beauty of the whole movement. That the trick probably just sort of slips by, and what you're left with is a feeling of great satisfaction.
Right.
And you may not even been paying attention to the trick specifically, but just this great feeling you have of something wonderful that just happened.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of times the audience will, when you have a volunteer on stage or you're doing close-up magic for an intimate group, there is much taken with watching their friend's reaction who's participating in it
mm-hmm.
as they are with the trick itself.
Yeah.
And if you notice, I believe that was, they tried doing magic on television for years, and Doug Henning was very successful with it because he did live television shows. But mm-hmm. then everything went to edits and taping mm-hmm. and they started to use trick photography mixed in with the magic, and audiences, even if they don't know that that's what's going on, can smell it. Mm-hmm. So it starts to feel more synthetic and less real.
Yeah.
And what was I about to say? I think television on magic didn't work for a lot of years until this guy David Blaine came along, a long, savvy, street smart kid who took a camera out, candid camera style, and people were blown away by him. However, if you look at those original shows, the camera was more focused on the people's expression watching him than what he was doing.
Yeah.
And he had relatively little experience as a performer. His face was kind of deadpan and not terribly interesting, but what was interesting was the audience reacting to him, and that's where the camera was focusing.
And of course they can edit out the most interesting.
Go out and do the trick to 20 different people and pick the one who's screaming the loudest or whatever they want to do.
Yeah. I saw a demonstration of some sort of psychological test where these people watched a video of a basketball game or something going on, I forget. I think it was actually a basketball, I think it wasn't a basketball game. It was a video of some people standing around talking and doing something, and they're supposed to count some event that was happening in the video. And then afterwards, they were asked how many times they saw a basketball player go by. And depending upon what they were asked to pay attention to in the scene, they would or would be, they would see, or they would be completely blind to the fact that this guy in an orange suit goes by dribbling a basketball, goes right past the camera, right in the front of everything. And if they're paying attention to something else in that scene, they were able to completely miss the basketball player and not even see him.
Do I have time for one last thing?
We've got about a minute and a half.
Okay. Just tying it back loosely, I don't have time to make the whole connection, but back to what you said at the beginning about when you and I first met and I said hypnosis was easy. Mm-hmm. I'm sure what I said, because it was a thing that I learned after 3 years of trying to do hypnosis, and then I learned selling, and which was, I think the thing that I said to you was, it's easy. All you got to do is you have to believe that you can do it,
right,
and convey that sense of belief to the person that's about
right,
to be
that, which is essentially what all those induction techniques I'd been studying were
right.
doing.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to mention that we said we'd tease the audience about, and I'll try and get it into our 45 seconds, was when you were on stage with your sleeves rolled up, and your hands out away from your body, no possibility of equipment being involved, and showing the audience both sides of your hand.
And then Maharishi was on
and
stage.
And Maharishi was sitting behind you.
And I had gone over to him before the show began, and I said, if you want to see what the audience is seeing, look at the monitor.
Right. Right.
If you want to see how it's working, look over at me.
Right.
And then you saw.
And I saw both. I was in the gap looking. I could look either way. I could see the audience, or I could see Maharishi looking at the monitors. And what the audience is seeing is Bill's pulling, you know, hundreds of playing cards out of thin air and dropping them on the floor.
And then Maharishi would look over at me and start laughing when he saw how ridiculously it was being done.
Yeah, and seeing how it's done reveals that the actual method of doing it is as impossible as what it appears to be from the front. It's just then it's a matter of manual dexterity that you can't believe anyone could achieve.
Mm.
But anyway, we're out of time. I'd like to thank you for joining us today. And our pre-program conversation was at least as interesting as the program itself.
It's been Bill Brunell, in case you just tuned in. Bill Brunell, and if he ever performs in Fairfield, just look for him to be advertised in the Weekly Reader and come and see him if he gives a show. I hope he does.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.